You know, every time I speak, I want the truth to come out. You know what I'm saying? Every time I speak, I want to shiver. You know, I don't want them to be like, they know what I'm going to say because it's polite. They know what I'm going to say. And even if I get in trouble, you know what I'm saying? That ain't that what we're supposed to do? I'm not saying I'm going to rule the world or I'm going to change the world, but I guarantee that I will spark the brain that will change the world.
I think what you're trying to ask is, why am I so insistent upon giving out to them that blackness, that black power, that black pushing them to identify with black culture? I think that's what you're asking. I have no choice over it. In the first place, to me, we are the most beautiful creatures in the whole world, black people. I mean, and I mean that in every sense, outside and inside. And to me, we have a culture that is surpassed by no other civilization, but we don't know anything about it. So again, I think I've said this before in this same interview, I think at some time before, my job is to somehow make them curious enough or persuade them by hook or crook to get more aware of themselves and where they came from and what they are into and what is already there, and just to bring it out. This is what compels me to compel them, and I will do it by whatever means necessary.
I am your host, Montoya Smith, a.k.a. Black Socrates, along with special guest co-host Latrice Ross, and welcome to the Mental Dialogue Talk Show. We are the return of intelligent radio as we ensure the free flow of opinions and push the envelope on the questions America's afraid to ask in the mainstream media. Good morning, Latrice. Glad to have you back in the saddle with me on this good Saturday morning. How are you doing, Queen? Say hello to the intellectual outcast before we introduce our special returning guest.
Good morning, Antonio. I'm great. I am happy to be here. And definitely interested in diving into this much-needed conversation.
No, absolutely. Without further ado, let's get Dr. Curtis Jasper, psychologist, on with us. Thank you for being with us, if you will, King. Glad to have you black with us, as I like to say. You've put in so much work in the community, and I really just really appreciate you making yourself available for these very important conversations. So if you will, King, introduce yourself to the intellectual outcast. Latrice, Dr. Kurt, as you like to be called, y'all say hello to each other and give a little bit of your background, and then I'm going to turn it back to Latrice to add her background before we get into this morning's discussion question. Go ahead, brother.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I appreciate y'all having me and doing this work. Montoya, man, I can't say enough for just your commitment to the community, bro. And whenever I can pull up, man, whenever I'm requested, if the schedule match, you know I'm going to do so. I'm Dr. Curtis D. Jasper, born and raised in Chicago. I currently live in Atlanta. I function and serve the world primarily through black mental health and black psychology, with my target group being mostly black men. I also contribute doing consulting and public speaking all around emotional wellness and black psychology. The whole idea of our topic today is very, very necessary and needed, and I do a lot of work around it, so I'm happy to be here to contribute and to learn something.
No, absolutely. Glad to have you. Great opportunity, Latrice. Thank you for assisting me with today's title, but before I let the cat out the bag on the discussion question, if you are a first-time listener, again, my name is Montoya, but I go by Black Socrates. We take the Socratic method, if you will, so we ask a question for all of our show titles, if you will, and have that dialogue. But if you will, Queen, I think some of your background will be helpful in this discussion. So anything that you would like to pull out of your background just to share with the audience. Again, you are one of my Queens of Intellect members and co-hosts, but I just want to make sure people understand you will be coming from a place of expertise when you speak as well. So whatever you want to give, go ahead and give it right now, Queen.
Sure. I am a diversity, equity, and inclusion consultant, and I've been doing it since about 2012. Being a black woman, that is my area of expertise, because not only is it from research, it's from lived experiences as well. And so this is definitely a much needed topic in our community. I'll be looking at it because black wellness, black health equity, those things are very important to me because I am a part of the community. Additionally, I have kids and a grandson, so I want them to be focus on their well-being, which is hard sometimes in a world like this.
No, absolutely. So without further ado, this morning's discussion question, shame shifting. How do I overcome feelings of inadequacy and shame? Again, that's shame shifting. How do I overcome feelings of inadequacy and shame? Latrice, the queen of this morning's show, we'll start with you as we always start. You actually helped me word this question. I kind of worded it a different way. And, you know, we like to try to word the question to draw as many listeners. No secret there. But when, you know, since you came up with the wording, now I have to turn around and ask you, you know, what was your thought in kind of constructing the question this way? What was your initial thought once you kind of just sat with the question? What was that thought?
I thought about many of my lived experiences, my interactions with people, and how so often we carry it. It's ever present in our daily interactions, and how, you know, there comes a time in our lives where for our own health and well-being that we have to decide how we're going to package or process those lived experiences that left us traumatized or feeling inadequate or imposter syndrome or whatever it might be, and how do we shift to a new frame of thinking. So that was my thought around it when you mentioned it to me.
No, sounds good. And Dr. Kerr, you are really the reason we're doing this show. I'm going to share your post that actually made me say, oh, let me think about this. And we're going to share it actually a little later. So if you're listening, you have to kind of stay tuned to hear that actual post. It's definitely worthy of hearing. But without revealing that post, when I reached out to you, well, not so much when I reached out, when you saw the actual flyer with the actual question, shame shifting, how do I overcome feelings of inadequacy and shame? Because you didn't know I were worded that way. So when you saw that actual particular question, do you recall what thought popped in your head seeing the question for the first time?
Exactly. It was perfectly worded, because I think the goal, my hope is that by the conclusion of this segment, the word shifting is the goal, right? Mm-hmm. It's the movement of shame. We all feel shame. There's no exceptions to that. But how do you move through that? So shifting is being synonymous with processing shame, which is a good thing, and I know we're going to get into it. So, yeah, brilliantly worded, in my opinion.
All right, and I have to give that brilliance to, once again, my queens of intellect. They always hold me down, which is a cadre of queens. I always try to get the co-host this show to make sure, you know, it ain't just the men folk on here giving our opinion. We want to make sure we have that balance, and I have to give that credit to Latrice. And I called her and said, you know, here you go, queen. You didn't put me to task. I'm having to do homework, because personally, I never heard the word. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I actually worded the question totally different than this. So had it been left to my own means, Dr. Curry, you wouldn't have been impressed. So I have to give credit to the queen of the show, Latrice. I had to literally go look this word up. And so her being in the space, no surprise. And sometimes I can even, let me admit this, and we can maybe talk a little bit about this before we go to our first break, is the idea of sometimes, you know, there's so many words that are, you know, brought into our vernacular here in the last decade, especially, if you will, from the DEI space, you know, and I'm not saying that this word particularly came from it, but some words, sometimes we like to use this word salad. And so when I first saw the word, I was like, all right, that sounds much better than anything I posted. But is this another one of those words? And then when I looked it up, I definitely understand what Dr. Kurt is referring to when he said it's brilliant. And I agree, that is absolutely going to be the goal. But we got about a minute before break. So Latrice, again, you were the brilliant one to kind of share this word. Clearly, you know what it means. But just any thoughts on, again, here I am learning as well. Again, no surprise from y'all. Y'all always challenge me. But any thoughts on that before we go to our first break?
No, just, you know, when I was thinking, because, you know, wellness is a part of the DEI space. And so, you know, I just wanted something that I felt that folks could use to as leverage to move forward, to move beyond shame and feelings of inadequacy. And so hopefully, as Dr. Kirk said, that will be what we accomplish.
No, absolutely. If you're out there listening, we will give you the number to get in after this break. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Mr. Dialogue Talk Show, where all I ask is that you think.
Hey, are you a wine drinker?
A little bit here and there, but my wife definitely loves hers. Why you ask?
Man, you gotta try this vegan wine by Sip and Share Wine. I ran across them at this event in Atlanta, and now I keep me a few bottles at the house. What flavor you like?
I mean, I like me a good red or maybe a nice dipping deal or something. You know what I'm saying?
Okay, try this sweet red first.
Okay, that's nice and smooth right there. Yeah, that's kind of sweet, like I like it. You know what I'm talking about?
For sure, that's why I like that one as well. Hey, now try this Conjure Zinfandel. This one was featured in Forbes magazine as a top 10 drink for the summer. See what you think.
Oh, okay. Now that's fire right there. Where can I get a bottle of that?
Just go to sipandsharewines.com. They'll ship it right to your door. They black on too.
Oh, yeah? Okay, you said what? Sipandsharewines.com? Is that it?
Yep.
Bad.
Have you heard about that podcast, Mental Dialogue? It's so good it should be illegal. But if you miss the live show every Saturday, 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Blog Talk Radio, be sure to catch replays on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Podbean, and all other streaming platforms. We are the return of intelligent radio, and we are the best in the world at having hard conversations on race, sex, gender, and business in the African-American community. And remember, all I ask is that you think.
Welcome back to the Mental Dialogue Talk Show. I'm your host, Montoya Smith, a.k.a. Black Socrates, along with special guest co-host Latrice Ross. This morning's discussion question, shame shifting. How do I overcome feelings of inadequacy and shame? Our special guest is Dr. Curtis Jasper. And so where I wanted to start when I first went down, I would say the rabbit hole, I said, let me figure out exactly what this word means. And again, applaud both of you of what the end goal, if you will, of this show will be. But I feel like I wanted to start here because when I first saw the word, I saw in a sense seeming to be used initially. What I found was a technique used by another common word in the word now used by narcissists in a sense to project shame onto others and things of that nature. And it's almost can be abusive, if you will. So when I first saw the word, it kept being used in that context. Ultimately, our goal is, in a sense, like I said, individuals who are faced with it, maybe they've, quote unquote, been abused by a narcissist who uses shame shifting as a tactic, if you will. And so don't want to spend a lot of time on that side of it versus the receivers and how, as we said, to get people out of it. But I think it's very appropriate to highlight how that's a place that it can be used intentionally. And I know a lot of people who have been abused by a narcissist have a lot of trouble coming out of that. So Dr. Curt, if you will, I'll start with you just highlighting that, the abuser side of it. Don't want to spend too much time there, but I feel it's only fair that we highlight that happens a lot, if you will. Go ahead, King. I'm sorry, let me bring him live. Sorry about that. You're live now, King. Sorry about that.
Okay. It does, Brother Montoya, with the exception of narcissism being overly used and improperly used and out of context. Mm-hmm. But it is a way to reverse blame. So when it comes to attempting to shame another, it's for one reason. It's to insert blame, right? And so people are referred to narcissists when they appear to be shamelessness, which doesn't mean the lack of shame. It's the refusal to accept shame. So whenever someone, we feel, it's just as individuals, that someone should be shameful and they are not, then we have a tendency of naming them as being narcissistic and things of that nature, which is totally out of context. When it comes to one person attempting to shame another, that's because the end goal is to place blame. And when the person doesn't readily receive it, that's reverse blame. So lots of things. I know I'm mentioning that. We'll peel them back as we go, I know. But that's what shows up when I heard your question, brother.
No, I love it. I got a quote from someone named Lily Hope Macario, I guess from Healing from Complex Trauma, that speaks to this as well. She just says, shame shifting, whenever a person shames an abuse survivor and denies them the right to state there was no excuse for the abuse inflicted on them. This is shame shifting. They are taking the shame only the abuser should feel and projecting it onto the victim. This is emotional abuse. Anything else you might want to highlight with that quote? And then I'll, Alan, get your thoughts on this as well, Latrice. Anything else you want to highlight, Dr. Kurt? And that's just, again, a quote from this particular file.
Yeah. I think we diminish and limit exactly what shame is. Shame, which is a part of guilt, are the two most misunderstood and uncomfortable human emotions. They're actually moral human emotions. We tend to think that they're bad things, which is why we provide context around them being bad things. They are actually misunderstood. And so I think learning what is shame exactly and how does shame differ and connect with guilt would be a burden lifted. And I deal with shame professionally probably about 80%. The basis of all disconnect has to do with some type of shame.
Man. Latrice, any thoughts on the quote or anything Dr. Kurt had to say?
Sure. I think I look at it, I think a lot of times the work I do, I'm looking for the root cause. And so, you know, when I think about the quote that was made, I think about, I just lost my train of thought, but I think that we as a community of people, we are oftentimes in the public sphere or in work or whatever, because of how bias plays out in our lives, many of us, I think, are subjected to experiences that cause us to feel shame, whether it's a black man at work who feels emasculated, whether it's a woman who feels that her voice has been quelled one too many times. All of those things that sort of came into my thoughts when I listened to you read that quote.
That sounds good. Let's get into that guilt versus shame, if you will, Dr. Kurt. Again, as I went down this rabbit hole, those, from what I understood just in my own reading and layman viewpoint of seeing this, guilt versus shame, you've already kind of said it, they are one, two different things. I also saw during this that guilt, the guilt to an extent, at least based on what I read briefly, is in a sense can be healthy. And not that shame in itself is bad, but there are levels to where it can become toxic. So if you could highlight the difference, because I'm pretty sure a lot of us make them one and the same, and from what I could tell, they're not, if you will. So we can kind of delineate between guilt and shame and how they could be healthy or harmful, if you will.
Sure. Because they're adaptive emotions, they actually have some good stuff at the end. So in layman's terms, the difference between shame and guilt is shame is the feeling of I am bad, and guilt is the feeling of I did something bad. And the basis of that usually is predicated on the early attachment styles of individuals, right? And learning how to separate those and uncollapse those from one's identity. And so we don't really understand how that works, right? All of us feel shame and guilt. There's no exceptions to that. It's part of the spectrum. It's part of the emotional spectrum. Both of them are feelings of worthlessness or not being good enough or unlovable in the very moment. But to get to guilt, you got to go through shame. So, for example, if I did something bad, I may feel that I'm bad because I did something bad. But because I'm able to process it in my attachment and I've experienced connection and trust enough, I'm able to go down that pathway, if you will, rather quickly. So I'm able to say, oh, man, like if I said something wrong or did something wrong, I can process at a record rate, like, oh, I did something bad. And the point of guilt is to change behavior or to provoke an apology, right? The point of shame is to move to guilt, right, so that we could change the behavior, right? So there's some good stuff, but because we don't like feeling bad, we don't like feeling bad. Anything that makes us feel bad, we kind of shy away from it. I know these conversations are helpful, and I thank you both, because this is the thing, though. There are no exceptions to that. We all feel it. Shame is the initial feeling of harm done, right? Most of us avoid shame either by fighting or fleeing or freezing, but we got to know how it works, right? And when we act like we are not able to be seen. That's because it's a usually a defense mechanism based on trauma responses from our earlier days.
Nah, it makes sense. And I wasn't even thinking about this as something I would bring up, but it's just as I listen to you, and again, I like how you kind of highlight that, you know, as you said, in themselves, they're not an issue. And so something that I personally think, kind of speaking to the larger culture, just very briefly, and we'll keep going down this for individuals, but from the, speaking to the larger culture, I have this thought that we're in an era now to, as you kind of mentioned, where people avoid it. I feel like even more than ever, if you will, these ideas of guilt and shame, I'm talking about the good aspects of it that you just mentioned, to the point where I would highlight there's, as a society, as a culture, even in the African-American community, that there's aspects of where shame could be good, and I see it used effectively sometimes towards a culture. Obviously, it could be overused, and we have that history. We're going to get into that as well. But to a certain aspect, shame being understood in a cultural way can create what we would consider, I'm not going to use the word proper behavior, but behavior that gets us better outcomes, if that makes sense. I'm being real general now, but I want to hear what you're hearing and what I'm saying before I add a specific example, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Can you give me a specific example?
Okay. Yeah, so like what comes to my mind is, for example, teenage pregnancy in the United States and throughout the world. Like there are places throughout the world where you see less and less of it. And I always like to be clear when I use this term, like teenage pregnancy has went down in the United States in a major way over the last 40 years. I still want to highlight that before people just assume I'm being negative. But there are places in the world where their culture, you see less of it because sometimes they're using an element of shame that attaches to it. And I'm not talking about the extremes of people getting abortions because it's so shameful. I'm just talking about you see that behavior where that's done less and less, where somebody's in a sense having a child before they're ready. That happens less and less when I think societal shame is used properly. That's the example I would use.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is the basis, because keep in mind that the shame is a moral human emotion, mostly, right, based on perfect alignment with what you said. And, of course, there's collective shame that we all experience just as black people with white supremacy and oppression. So lots to come with that. But the goal is to move from shame to guilt. And keep in mind the basis of it all is to either induce an apology or change the behavior. Right, which we all can. We all drop the ball. The initial feeling of harm done, that's shame. To be able to move to guilt, to change the behavior, to provoke an apology, is a moral gift that we could all give to ourselves. Now, what we deal with in current times is embarrassment, right? Mm-hmm. We don't like that, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's memorialized on online and social media, we immediately think that it won't go away even when we have moved past it. So that's when shame becomes sensationalized.
Wow, makes sense. Latrice, any thoughts to, you know, I just, again, it's this idea that popped in my head when Dr. Kurt was talking, that, you know, I actually think there's a place for shame in society, and again, I'm using it in today's context, where we as a society almost try to avoid the whole word in itself. We kind of, as I always say, we throw out the whole baby with the bath water instead of understanding how, I would say, shame can collectively be used effectively to create some behavior. Again, that's my opinion. But any thoughts to, you know, me saying that in general, the good side of it, and then we're going to definitely delve into the bad side of this to continue this conversation.
Yeah, I don't know, because when I heard your thought, and it's amazing how our lived experiences cause us to perceive things differently, because I was a teen mother, mm-hmm. and I was, my grandmother took me to church every Sunday, and when I got pregnant, after my daughter was born, I had to go stand in front of the church and apologize, and so that brought on, I was embarrassed, it brought on feelings of shame, And those are things that I had to work through in therapy that were continuing to impact me as an adult. So I had to like pull myself out of that place, as you've mentioned that example. So that's kind of where I got stuck for a few seconds. And so what made me think about is that we have to remove ourselves from those who place us in those situations to feel those feelings of shame.
Yeah, that example was near and dear to me. I actually wrote about it in my book I just released, Reeducation of the Negro, where I highlighted my 13 at the time, where she had to do the exact same thing you did. And I think that level of action to my mother, I know it harmed her having to make that apology, and it stayed with her, I would say, even still to this day. I don't know if she would say it, but that's just my personal opinion. It was highlighting that I thought that far, in a sense, was terrible. Although societal and culture-wise, I get what they were hoping to do, but I can admit, I would say your situation and obviously my own mother's situation was extremely harmful to the individual. So I don't necessarily know if I have the answer, but I get societal say, hey, this is not something we want, and if you do this, you, in a sense, bring shame to the name and the family. And families do it within their own culture, whatever culture they want. So it's like a balancing act that I don't necessarily have the answer to, but I am also willing to admit the scenario you just gave, I think, can be quite harmful to the individual, in my opinion. Dr. Kerr, any thoughts on, you know, this example of what Latrice went through? And again, I put in my book that I think it was incredibly wrong for our church family, if you will, to do that to my young mother, you know, and I'll admit that. Any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of the basis of how we were raised, right? As young boys and young girls, as boys, we were told more of what to do. And for girls, they were told more of what not to do. Mm-hmm. The majority of girls, women now that I work with, and I got three daughters and a granddaughter of my own, most girls were raised on shame to change the behavior. Don't do this, don't do that, don't get pregnant, don't cross your legs, don't be fast, don't run with a dress on, don't play with the boys, don't write, right? So no wonder they don't hear us as brothers when we correct them now, right? Because they've been shamed or attempted to be shamed. And you don't blame them, right, when you get that, because they've been somebody been telling them what not to do their whole life. And the reason that they've been told what to do has been through shame. It wasn't through connection. It was through shame. It was through embarrassment. And they had to work through that, as Latrice just told us, right, publicly. Who can do that? As brothers? Come on, man. I wouldn't be in business if we all knew how to work through shame, right? Shame. But here's the beautiful thing about shame. Right, shame moves to guilt through repair, which is the basis of therapy. Shame moves to guilt through repair. Guilt is much lighter than shame. How do you repair that? Through attunement, through connection, through trust with another. That's how you repair shame, right? I'm a professional secret keeper, right? I hear secrets all day long. The minute those secrets are revealed, the shame dissipates. The connection is there. Wow. When they hear another brother said, I get it, I hear it, you're not alone, I've been there, I hear that every week, trust me, bro, I know they shamed you, or sis, they shamed you, I can assure you, you're in a group of somewhere about 80 or 90%. Because here's the reality, right? I had a child at 16. I didn't even know it, but her mother was shamed. But because they didn't tell me, I was able to go to college, graduate school, start a family of my own until 21 years later. So I wasn't shamed because I was a teenage father, but I felt guilty that I missed 21 years. Her mama is still dealing with the shame. But that's the distinction between a boy and a girl.
Mm.
Right?
Oh, wow.
We're not playing today, y'all.
Yeah. That's major. And you speaking through a situation, my best friend went through that. Like the exact same, you know, maybe wasn't 21 years, but 10 years later, went through that exact same thing. Like, his situation was fortunate enough to get his child and be able to work through it hand to hand and catch him while he was young. Because I can't imagine, you know, what you went through with your daughter, you know, with finding out as an adult. I can't even imagine what that looks like. Oh, man, that's amazing. Yep. We're up against another break, man. I'm going to go to this break. We're going to come back, and we're going to get on to this from an individual standpoint. Let me give out the phone number for anybody that might want to get in, ask a question, anything you're dealing with. We got the – I think Dr. Kurt is the man when it comes to the psychology thing. So, you know, please get in here and ask your questions of anything you want to work through. As he just mentioned, he's a professional secret keeper. I never thought of it that way. I like that term, brother. But you are in a safe space today with this brother, if you will, if you want to call in. That number is 646-787-1691. Again, that's 646-787-1691. You do have to press 1 to let us know you want to speak. If you just want to listen via phone, no problem. We'll be right back and listening to the Mental Dialogue Talk Show, where all I ask is that you wait.
LNG Technology Services, we are your industry leader in aircraft and heavy equipment repair services. In commercial business for over 15 years, LNG technicians have over 150 years of equipment-specific knowledge and are known industry-wide for returning worn-out, broken, and overused ground support equipment back to the user in working better than new conditions. For a service job done right at a value unparalleled in the industry, contact LNG Technology Services at 478-781-4860. Again, for a service job done right, that number is 478-781-4860. LNG Technologies is a Mental Dialogue Gold member and proud sponsor of the Mental Dialogue community.
Welcome back to the Mental Dialogue Talk Show. I'm your host, Montoya Smith, a.k.a. Black Socrates. This morning's discussion question, shame shifting. How do I overcome feelings of inadequacy and shame? My special guest co-host, Latrice Ross. Our special guest is Dr. Curtis Gasper. So I want to share the definition of toxic shame. Again, getting into, I would say, some of these words, Salas, and these words we use today. But toxic shame is a feeling that you're worthless. It happens when other people treat you poorly and you turn that treatment into a belief about yourself. You're most vulnerable in this type of poor treatment during childhood or as a teen. Just a real quick example, even from last night's Mental Dialogue Live experience. Shanae, if you remember her, Dr. Curtis, she was actually on the soapbox, and she actually won the soapbox last night, just highlighting that. But her father mentioned, and this is something that's real simple, but it fits right into this morning's discussion, mentioned how when he was a young kid, one of his music teachers pointed out, like, the bass in his voice said that he couldn't really sing or whatever. He was saying last night, based on some of the conversation we were having, how, you know, even as a grown man to this day, it affects him even being willing to sing, even though he has a nice bass band, but because of what he recalls from her, he couldn't express that, and it bothered him even still to this day. And so that's what this reading toxic shame and this poor treatment during childhood, teen, even though a small example like that has stayed with him well into his 50s. So again, I know it affects a lot of areas, but I just thought that was a cool little thing that came out of last night's event that fits exactly into this definition. Your thoughts, King?
Yeah, I mean, again, it's misunderstood. Lots of people, they hold on to those examples outside of the house because of what was done and not done in the house, right? So without having a secure attachment, you hold on to shame. You hold on to the part of, not only did I do something bad, I am bad. Right, and that's a previously learned adaptive experience from the house. So because that seed wasn't planted, when you go out, whether it's a teacher or a pastor or somebody else, then they get to plant the seed, right? And so the distinction is, how do I move from shame back to guilt? And the way to do that is through repair, right? Through repair. But we ain't taught none of this. We just taught if we did something bad, that we were made to feel bad, as opposed to saying we were made to be pointed out that you did something bad. The basis of guilt is the feeling of wanting to do better after shame. That's why shame, moving to guilt, is the gift. Guilt is a lighter emotion. The basis of guilt is the feeling of wanting to do better after shame. We all go through shame. The question is not, do we all feel shameful? The question is, how many of us are still stuck in shame?
Any thoughts, Latrice, anything you heard?
I'm thinking as I began to work through many of my issues through therapy, one of my issues was that I was a perfectionist. And as I worked with my therapist, we got to the bottom of it, and it was my mother never accepting anything less than. So I was always trying to live up to something with her. For instance, I always say I've never been great in math, but that's because I brought home B's and they weren't good enough. I got grounded for bringing home a B in geometry instead of an A. And so that, not realizing as an adult why I was always late finishing projects, why things never got done, it was because I was always working to ensure that every single thing was absolutely perfect and there was absolutely nothing that no one could say to disparage or malign my work. And that's not effective. It's not efficient and it's not effective. And it's like you're on this hamster wheel that you can't get off because perfection is really an illusion.
No, it makes sense. And I've always been a people watcher, and I've always, in a sense, I would say, Dr. Kurt, naturally have enjoyed the field of psychology. I'm a psychology enthusiast, if you will. But I remember kind of my first extent of realizing how much I loved how the mind worked. And this is something I got through observation. Then I remember when I actually took the class in college, I hated all the nomenclature that went with it. Like, I got to memorize all this nomenclature. Like, all this stuff makes sense to me, but I would get a B in the class just because that part was such a memory for me, right? But I felt like I understood it. And the example I would love to give, I didn't prepare for this. We were just having this dialogue. But I remember in college walking on to Division I football team, if you will. And I remember, I went to the prep school. I went to the prep school for a year, and I met this guy. He played a couple of years. I played a couple of years. Then I started boxing. But this guy in particular, he was a tight end for our football team. This mug had amazing talent. He was definitely the best tight end that kind of, in a sense, went to the prep school with us. And then we would go up to become freshman at the college or whatever. So he was very well touted coming out of high school. It was clear he had the most talent. And I remember the at the prep school, he was really big guy, could move fast. And this one day he made this amazing move and he dropped the pass. And it was like he was wide open and he just dropped the pass. Then another couple, maybe a week later, same thing, made this great move on some of our best DBs, wide open, dropped the pass. So, you know, at that age, we're coming out of high school, we're ruthless, right? Just in general, like, that's the thing you do. Somebody mess up, you kind of dog them out and keep it going. But I watched that moment, but it wasn't just the players, it was the coaches too. I watched it get in his head, and I watched a dude that literally, I was a receiver, that's why I remember all this. He had the best hands of all of us. A year later, he couldn't catch anything. The reason I remember it is because I went through the same thing in high school. I was touted as a pretty good, I was a D-back. I'd love to play a defensive back more, but I was touted as a good receiver, you know, eventually coming out of my freshman year. And I remember having a couple of drops similar to him, but it wasn't my teammates. My coaches did it the most. And so when I watched it happen to him, it was at that moment that I realized, damn, that's what happened to me. Now, I didn't get to the point where this guy stopped where he couldn't catch anything. I didn't get to that point, but I went from being one of the top receivers on our team to someone whose hands were just okay or whatever, and it literally stuck with me to the point when I saw it happen to him. I was like, he has great hands, but it's the psychology of living up to what people have been pushing to has changed this dude's trajectory. He quit the team.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, happens all the time.
Yeah, I read a book. I picked it up in the airport a few years back, and it was, I can't remember the name of it, but maybe, I think it was How Children Learn, but it talked about the concept of principals list and honor roll and how that actually has, when we push that, our kids towards that, that has a negative impact on them. And instead, we should be pushing them to do their best work, whatever that is. But but not have that you didn't make honor roll, so you're grounded. That was my existence. But what we do, this was the part that really stuck with me from that book. What it does to our kids is it teaches them if we can't hit that mark, that specific mark, then I'm not going to venture into that area. And so we teach them to essentially survive in a box. And if this plays out when they go to college, let's say they are a computer engineering major, they've come from a small school and they're accustomed to making the honor roll and the principal's list. But when they go to college and get that first C in a computer engineering course, many of them will change directions and go major in something easier, something, you know, social work, sociology, something that's not as difficult or challenging as computer engineering, because we've taken that sense of experimentation and curiosity away from them, because we've taught them that if you can't get this A, then it's not good and you're going to be in trouble. And so we don't, you know, that has a negative impact. So when I see my friends now, you know, harping on their kids because they didn't make the honor roll in the principal's list, I share with them that book and that they should get it and read it, because they're hindering their ability to achieve later on in life.
And what's the name of that book again?
I think it's called How Children Learn. I have it on the bookshelf, so I'll find out for certain.
Yeah, we definitely want that, because I'm pretty sure, like, that's a tough balance in that, wouldn't you think, Dr.? Because I can imagine, you know, you want your child to do well, and we use the, in a sense, stratification of grades, and, you know, for the most part, pushing your child to make great grades, if you will, you think is what I want to do, what I expect to do, but without realizing how, like the example Latrice just gave, pushes a lot of our black children out of the STEM degrees, because that happens quite often if you don't come from a strong background to be, in a sense, ready for STEM. Again, it can happen in plenty of areas, but Dr. Kurt, like, how do we even make parents aware of this to where they can balance it out in raising their children? You have children. Maybe you have a way of dealing with this, or how did you deal with it with your children to avoid them only wanting the stratification of a grade in a way that harms them, if that makes sense?
Right. It's really the work of individualized parenting, right? I hear a couple things when I'm listening to you. There's this whole collective shame about if we're good enough, particularly as college students. But shamed parents shame their kids. Even on their best days, you can be a great parent and still have not worked through your own shame.
Mm-hmm.
And you put that on your baby, right? No exceptions to that. The goal is to understand the basis of guilt and shame. Even if you're a parent at my age with grown children, my mother personally understood it. She was able to teach me the difference between who I am versus what I did or didn't do. So my identity was there. I was fortunate, right? But the majority of the people that I know and work with, they were not. Now, my father used the shame, but because I lived primarily with my mother, I didn't take it on. My mother was clear about you, me and you are good. I have to help you change the behavior based on the thing that you did, right? And that's the basis. There is no perfectionism. When parents push children, what they're saying is the synonym for perfectionism is worthlessness,
ooh,
period. And if we limit our children to academic achievement, that's because we haven't worked on our own shame, not guilt, shame, right?
Ooh.
Because, again, guilt is the feeling of wanting to do better, right? Your identity is intact. It's the feeling of wanting to stay connected. Right? I got to stay connected to my family, my parents' expectations, right? We do more guilt and shaming than we do setting the expectation bar. The lack of connection, the lack of trust keeps us stuck in shame. And so we think it's in the head. It ain't in the head. It's in the body, right? When you drop that pass, it ain't because you overthought it. It's because that shame is stored in your body.
Ooh.
And when that pass comes from that quarterback, because that shame is stored in your body, your consciousness in your body, you drop that pass. You drop that pass. People do it all the time. We do it now, right? But the basis of it is, how do we move from shame to guilt without allowing people we know and love from feeling shut off from the world? You and I, done. We talked about suicide. We talked about just crashing out. We see a lot of things shooting up. We see crazy things now. How do we move from shame to guilt so that we will not have a large number of people who feel shut off from the world?
Yeah, that's a great question. We're up against the break. We actually got a caller that wants to get in too, so we'll get to the caller and maybe we can delve into what you just, in a sense, asked to all of us. How do we move? Yeah, how do we do that? Let's get into that after this break. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Mental Dialogue Talk Show, where all I ask is that you think. 217, last 3002, we will get you coming out of the break. We'll be right back.
Truth seekers, please understand, Mental Dialogue is much more than just a talk show. Each and every Saturday, we communicate with you for two reasons, to dialogue and connect. On the dialogue side, we cater to you intellectual outcasts who feel you have no place for honest discourse on race, sex, culture, and African-American business. On the Connect side, we've created a community where you can connect with experts specifically in finance, whether personal or business, and mental health, whether it's trauma or to optimize performance, along with all the other skill sets from other MD community members. Our mission was to create a virtual nationwide neighborhood where African Americans learn to trade ideas, goods, and services through social media, meetup, and this podcast. To become a neighbor of the Mental Dialogue Community Club, please visit us at mentaldialogue.com. We are better with you than we are without you. We can be neighbors even though we don't live next to each other. Hashtag raise the culture.
Welcome back to the Mental Dialogue Talk Show. I'm your host, Montoya Smith, a.k.a. Black Socrates, along with special guest co-host Latrice Ross. This morning's discussion question, shame shifting. How do I overcome feelings of inadequacy and shame? Our special guest is Dr. Curtis Jasper. Let's get to a caller, area code 217, last 3002. Give us your name, where you're calling from, and your 3 cents or question on this morning's discussion question.
How you doing, gentlemen? My name is Joshua from East Central Illinois. And
hey,
my take on that is,
what you got for us?
Yes, sir. I don't know. I guess the easiest way to deal with that is a little bit of sarcasm, a little bit of humor, and a little bit of humility.
Okay. And you're just kind of throwing that out? You're just making a statement that you think all of those help you deal with this? I'm just making sure if that's all you – if you got other things to say, go ahead. You just pause. I didn't know if that's kind of – that was just your thought. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, you're fine. Shame is when you are ashamed, when you're personally responsible for something, immediately you should probably reconcile that. But a lot of this stuff, you got to have a little bit of a sense of humor about it, if that makes sense to anybody.
No, it does. Let me say this, and then I'll see what Dr. Kurt says about it. So feeling like I gave even my little personal example with football, and I'll even admit this, Dr. Kurt, that, you know, that even that stuck with me in other areas of my life. It wasn't just passes. It was like even admitting that when I saw what happened to the tight end, it brought back, oh, that's what happened to me, because I didn't understand it until I saw it happen to him. But that stayed with me for years in other areas of my life, even though I wasn't playing football any longer, just throwing it out, Dr. Kurt. But I do hear the caller saying, hey, here's a couple of ways to deal with some of it. I do feel like I don't take on guilt and shame in a lot of other areas because I use some of what this caller is saying as a technique and I'm not just laughing it off to laugh it off. I literally find some of the mistakes I make sincerely funny, and therefore it doesn't ever set with me. So I find some personal validity in what the caller is offering. Your thoughts, Dr. Kurt?
So we do a lot of things as trauma defenses, right? Coping mechanisms, right? So there's a difference between laughing it off and then reflecting back and laughing, right? So mm-hmm. we do a lot of defending a shame. Like when we feel in shame, we immediately start laughing. We'll add humor. That is to offset the feeling of shame, which never really works. You got to finish the feeling of shame. Now, after you finish and work through that, then you, in retrospect, say, man, that was crazy. I did this. I'm like, then that's different. But in place, when the feeling of guilt or shame comes up in the body, and your defense mechanism is because you have taught yourself that trauma response, right? But it doesn't work. It doesn't go away because the shame still is in there. And because it's in there, it becomes suppressed and repressed, which means it got to come out at some point. So when you start piling up this shame, this giggle, joke, what you have not done is properly processed shame. The goal is to move from shame to guilt. And guilt is a lighter feeling. That's the feeling of wanting to do better. Whenever we are embarrassed or feeling uncertain or unlovable or worthless, that's shame. We caused harm. That's the initial feeling of harm. To avoid shame, we fight, we flee, we giggle, we laugh. That's avoiding shame. There is no such thing as shamelessness. We go through shame, we get to guilt, we change the behavior, we enforce the apology, and we take personal responsibility. That's the goal. Personal responsibility, apology, moral growth. Anything else is prolonging the benefits of moving from shame to guilt.
No, it makes sense. Say your name again, Carlo. I want to refer to you by your name. I'm sorry.
Yes, my name is Joshua. No, that actually makes a lot of sense. No, I was talking about reconciliation before laughter.
No, I love it. Love the explanation by Dr. Kirk. Thank you for the call. If you want to get back in or make a habit of calling in, we would definitely appreciate people getting in. For anybody out there listening, thank you. I'm sorry. Thank you for the call, brother. But for anybody else that wants to get in, I see some other callers out there. You have to press 1 to let us know that you want to speak. If you're online and want to get in, the number is 646-787-1691. Again, that's 646-787-1691. I found this as well. Some researchers suggest that shame comes from repeatedly being told not that we did something bad, but that we are something bad. Consequently, it can close us off from accepting any form of positive regard from others or ourselves. So I see this comment quite often and I always highlight it amongst people I care about or amongst my friends. One of the ways I see this quote is when I see someone who has the inability to accept a compliment. A lot of times, especially if I get to know them, I know that there's a viewpoint they have of themselves, so they always downplay the compliment because they don't see themselves as that. So quite often, I feel like there's a sense of shame when I see that play out often within someone. Any thoughts on that, Dr. Kurt, as well as Latrice, both of y'all can kind of give me your thoughts on that.
Yeah, again, the basis of it is shame, right? We've been processed, a lot of us been raised with this whole idea of being given compliments and having them taken back in the same breath. You look good, but don't let that go to your head. You got all A's, but keep in mind next month, like we have that, right? The adults around us had great intentions. They missed it. So we learn to hide in plain sight. So when we become adults and someone says, you look good, that part of that voice in our head and our body saying, but yeah, you don't look that good, or be careful, or don't let them do this, right? So it's that I've taught myself how to hide in plain sight, whether that's deflecting a compliment or not. It's the basis of shame. And as a people, we missed it. And because we missed it and we don't understand it, we pass that on to our children on our best day. We just do. Right? I'm more of an educator than a psychologist, right? My job is to learn this stuff and share it with the world so that we can see it, feel it, and practice it different. But we don't get the difference between shame and guilt. The gift is it allows us to increase our consciousness, right? I want to have the feeling of guilt. I want to initially say, man, I caused harm. How do I repair this? How do I take personal responsibility? Is apology needed? Is there some moral personal growth and development that I could use as opposed to trying to do everything to not feel the feeling of shame? Shame means I did something that's harmful. Let me get to guilt so I can process this. How do I learn how to process this? Through therapy, through attunement, through connection, through trust.
That makes sense. Latrice, any thoughts? I want to share a quote to Dr. Kurt that actually made me do this show because of this thing he posted, but I want to see if you had any thoughts before I share that.
No, just that the two resources I was mentioning earlier is the book How Children Succeed, Grit, okay. Curiosity, and the Hidden Power of Character, and the online resource is the Efficacy Institute by Dr. Jeffrey Howard.
No, I appreciate that. Dialogue and connect is what we do best. We're not here just to talk. Anytime we can give you resources for any of these conversations where we can move our culture along, that's what we're really here for. I hope you are enjoying it. And I know we have to be a little entertaining, but at the end of the day, we're more about the business of our community. With that said, here's the actual post that said, it was just curious to me, and again, you always do a great job. I definitely highly recommend that people follow you on IG, Dr. Kurt, but you put out a post that said, "Dear Black man, just so you know, shame is a social/communal emotion, eternally individualized, and cannot be healed alone, my brother. You dig? Talk to someone safe. Dr. Kurt." I'll just let you peel that back as is, brother.
Yeah, I mean, the shame is destructive, right? We do a lot of things to overcome shame. I posted that, as I do every day, with the hopes of sparking something like this, right? And also reminding myself, right? It's one of those things where if we choose to internalize it and hide, it'll fester. It turns into anger, rage, overcompensated, a lot of things, right? But it's a good thing. It's designed for us to recognize that we caused harm. It's also designed for us to separate who we are from what we did. It keeps us morally and personally responsible. There's the good part. There's more goodness on feeling guilt and shame than the notion of it doesn't feel good, right? We can get past that. It doesn't. We don't like it. It doesn't feel good. Well, we know that the average emotion stays in the body about 90 seconds until we do or not do the things that keep it around longer. So if we learn how to process this through the body, if we learn techniques to stay connected to the community, because if you're holding on to something shameful and you share it with someone who's safe, right, like we're doing now, then you get to help carry that burden. You get to get help carrying that burden. Shame is very destructive. Now, keep in mind, ain't no such thing as shamelessness. We all feel shame. The goal is not to get stuck. If you get stuck in shame, then it becomes hope and helplessness.
And so here's the thing that made me say, I got to do a show on this because, you know, obviously there's a push and we're getting better as a community as far as getting therapy and things of that nature. But here's my but. I don't know until you make this post that it's even understood that shame is something I should get therapy for. And I'm highlighting that because there are so many other words that are attached to where, you know, families and friends may suggest you might need to go get therapy, right? Like, you know, whether it's depression, whether it's suicidal thoughts, like there's these other major terms that we're, as a culture, slowly coming to grips with even better. But as you just mentioned, 80% of people you're dealing with, this shame thing is a part of it. But I don't know if that's ever been the advice. And I saw your post and I was like, when you said, here's the thing that stood out the most, you cannot be healed alone. I would offer most people, this ain't even just a Black people thing, I would say the majority of people have no idea, one, when their guilt and shame has moved to a quote-unquote toxic level, for those that, you know, that it gets to that point, whatever area it may be. But when it's moved, you really think, I am expected to figure this part out on my own. And I think what we do, and you've already kind of mentioned this, is you spend all of your life avoiding it instead of dealing with it. But according to what you just said, my dealing with it, once it's got to a certain level, I may not be able to do it myself.
Right, because you didn't cause it yourself. See, here's the thing, shame ain't self-imposed. The damage, somebody caused the damage, that means somebody got to help you heal it. Shame can't thrive in connection. It just can't. it thrives in disconnection, right? So you don't, I'm not necessarily saying you got to go to therapy to shame, to go through shame.
I see what
you're saying. But you have to know that shame can't thrive in connection, right? It cannot. If you kill somebody and you've been holding that shame and you talk to another killer, I ain't saying you ain't going to feel shame going to be totally gone, but it won't thrive like it once did because it's connection. It's trust. You got it out, right? There's a difference between I did something bad versus I am bad. Now, when it comes to toxic shaming, right, the basis of toxic means poisonous. That means too much. Too much of anything is destructive. Too much water ain't good for us, right? So when we add toxic to anything, the offset is tonic. How do we move? If you have been burdened with shame coming up, you may find that you married someone to carry that torch, right, subconsciously because it's stored in the body, right, not in the mind. You get that it don't feel good. You get that it ain't healthy for you. But because you haven't let it go in the body, your body keeps score. Your body keeps score, right? And so part of that, getting that shame out, is to move to guilt so that we can repair it. How do we repair it? Attunement, trust with another, connection. That's how we repair it.
No, I love it.
Oh, that shame's there.
No, I love it. We're at the top of the hour, so we're going to go to another break here. But I'm going to say this very briefly. Oh, you're making so much sense, Dr. Kurt, because shame moves us into isolation. But you, as you said, it cannot live in connection. It's like we run away when we should run towards it and tell it. And as you said, the first time you said it earlier in the show, when you talk to someone and says, hey, you're not the only one, that's the start of something. And shame runs us to isolation all the time. There's so many things we don't want people to know. And that's how we end up living in it. Makes so much sense. We're up against the break. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Mental Dialogue Talk Show, where all I ask is what you think.
Hey, where did you get that hat and t-shirt? I like that.
Oh, I got this at moneymotivation.com. It's fresh, right?
Yes, and I love the message on it, too. You are the hustle, huh?
That's what the shirt says. I am the hustle. They embody the entrepreneur spirit, and what I like the most, it's more than a brand, it's a lifestyle for those who want to put in the work and expect to have the finer things in life. I also follow them on Instagram. Check this post out.
If you believe money is the root of all evil, you're using it wrong?
Or how about this one? Excuses made $0 an hour.
I like those. What's their IG?
At moneymotivation.co.
But do they have any ladies' gear?
Yes, you're going to love the clothing line they got for the ladies. Matter of fact, pull up their website, moneymotivation.com, and I'm going to get you a few things so we can both look like money. Everywhere I go, go, and everywhere I be, I don't even talk, they still know it's me. Cause I look like money, smell like money, talk like money, even walk like money.
I started to look at the African-American experience, starting with slavery, as a real clear, long-enduring trauma. I started to see that there were clear connections between that survival behavior and contemporary living in African-American experience. I started to see common behaviors that I took for granted as, well, cultural. There's adaptive behaviors, survival behaviors. Well, what are they? Let's just say 2019, you have a black mother and a white mother. The sons go to school together. They find themselves at a meeting. The black mother leans over to the white mother and says, I just wanted to mention to you that I noticed that your son is really doing quite well. And the white mother's response is, oh, thank you. She begins to go on and on about he won the science fair, his uncle's an astronaut. She's just oozing. She realizes the black mother's son is actually excelling her son. And she says, well, wait a minute. Your son's the one that's really coming along. And the black mother responds, oh, my God, he's a handful, but, oh, he just works my nerves. Now, when I'm working with African-American people, it doesn't matter what the audience is. It doesn't matter what class. If I were to ask, is she very proud while she's saying those denigrating things? And everybody laughs and goes, of course, there's a secret. Because everybody black knows that even though the black mother is going, oh, my God, she's really proud. So now let's roll that scene back 300 years. And let's say this black mother is working in the fields. And a white slave owner comes through and says, wow, that boy is really coming along. What is she going to say? No, he's not. He's stupid. He's
You're shiftless. You can't work because I don't want you to sell them. So I denigrate them to protect them. That is called appropriate adaptation when living in a hostile environment. The little white boy, say Timmy, you know, he feels really comfortable and happy about what his mom just said about him. And Trey looks at his mom and wonders, why can't you be proud of me? Because he doesn't understand the secret yet. And by the time he learns the secret, he will have already been injured by it. Post-traumatic slave syndrome.
Appropriate adaptive behavior. I know we all relate to what we just heard too much. Latrice, I'm going to start with you. But I highlight those that were appropriate adaptive behavior because we don't realize that same story we're still telling here in 2023 is actually based on history, appropriate adaptive behavior, and in not realizing it, it's still with us. Your thoughts, Queen?
I thought it was powerful, the example that you gave, and I've read the book Post-Traumatic Slave Syndrome, and definitely we still carry a lot of those behaviors into our present-day practices. A few years ago, I made a quote about whipping our kids is a throwback from slavery. And the amount of pushback that I got from people, that the commenting went on for weeks on that post because people were so triggered by it because my mother and dad, my parents whipped me and I'm okay. It's not a throwback to slavery. Our kids need it. And even when I said if there were an alternative, would you use it? Most of them said no. So that just confirms, you know, that those conversations that I had with people that we just adapt, and because it's been handed down from our grandparents to our parents now to us, it has to be the right way to do things. No logic other than just being handed down.
And so, Dr. Kurt, I'll go back to that word. I love how she, again, appropriate adaptive behavior. If I pull back that terminology, she's just highlighting it was an appropriate, meaning it's an appropriate adaptation to the survival of the children at the time. It's not that she's saying it's appropriate today, but it's a it's a better understanding for one, why and where it came from. I would challenge, it's like once you understand, oh, that's why it was done, that's the first revelation to start realizing, oh, I don't need to do it anymore. I understand why it was done at the time under those circumstances. It's like a wake-up call to say, in 2023, that's not the circumstances, so why am I still doing it? And without that, I think that's why Latrice sees the type of pushback she saw on the post that she just highlighted, because we never make that connection. Not that I'm saying we should. I think it takes these kind of conversations to have the revelation, if that makes sense. Your thoughts, King? I'm sorry, I got you muted again. I'm sorry. For the callers out there, I saw another caller jump on. You do have to press 1 if you want to get in. All right, go ahead, Dr. Kurt. Sorry about that.
Yeah, I mean, I get it. The PTSS is real. The notion of appropriate adaptive behavior is predicated on being in survival mode, right? And that's, you know, that's all of us. That is a result of being enslaved. And so one of the things that I found that gets in our way collectively is that we like to hang around in the awareness, knowledge, accumulation, understanding part. Because as Black people, we get online and try to match wits and share our insights, right? We like to do that, not understanding that the work is in the healing department, not the awareness department,
right?
The healing. So most of us, we could have degrees to the you know what. We could have the mm-hmm. bank account. We still operate in survival mode. We still operate hypervigilant, as opposed to lifestyle management mode, which is part of your healing journey. So when we talk about the basis of whipping our kids, now we all know that, or at least most of us. How beneficial was it? Well, it depends, right? Was it used to as a punitive method, or was it used to correct behavior? And so the challenge becomes that most of our kids, not most, a lot of our kids vacillate between their self-identity. They have not been taught how to separate who they are from what they have done or not doing, right? Every time I sit down with a black man, I said, my number one goal is to allow you to go back, if you never had, to feel proud about who you are, regardless of what you've done and what you've been through. That's my way of saying we just hit a hill. We're not here to match wits. We're not here to hang around in the cerebellum area and talk wits, right? You're not necessarily going to inherit appropriate adaptive behavior that are unuseful to you, right? Right? There is a gift from moving from survival mode to lifestyle management mode, and it ain't predicated on your bank balance or your degrees. And so that's the work is the healing journey. And you know, Dr. Joy McGrew, she does a lot of work, right, of teaching us that, like where all this stems from. The goal is, what are we going to do now that we got this information?
No, absolutely. And again, that's part of the dialogue here, because she ends it saying, you know, Trey, as she mentioned in the example, is sitting there wondering and injured by this mistake that I think we can agree a lot of parents unknowingly are making. But I can remember being that kid in certain situations where the kid can't process, or as she mentioned, knows the secret. And so it's like, absolutely, here's the awareness. I would offer Dr. Kirk that there's not enough in our community that have the awareness. I would just kind of throw that out. And so they continue to, in a sense, denigrate, not knowing that they have adaptive, appropriate behavior with plenty of, like, as she said, an example, with plenty of pride in their children, but accidentally harming their children with the denigration because of being unaware, if you will. And so what is, let's talk about that healing. Like, so let's say a parent is listening to this and says, oh man, I didn't realize I do this. What does that look like? How does the, in your opinion, how does that parent find a way to catch themselves? Because, you know, for example, let's say a parent heard this for the first time today and realized, oh, man, I do this to my child. You know it's not automatic. So what does that look like in your opinion where a parent said, I want to improve how I speak to my child. I don't want to be passing down this generational curse or trauma. What does that look like for a parent catching themselves in your opinion?
A lot of ways consistently, right? And so our blueprint from parenting is how we've been parented. No exceptions to that, with the exception of breaking through the conditioning. So again, you could be the best parent on the globe. There's still healing work. Our natural blueprint on parenting is how we were parented, right? We may attempt to do it differently, but without going inside doing that real healing work, we pass on these things. We package them differently. Right, we good talking now, right? We do the same, right, with slight variation, and it lands just as impactful, right? And so the healing has to start from the parent standpoint. I get calls every week from black families saying that my black son is struggling with his identity, right? He's not performing. I said, let me guess, you got him in a predominantly white private school, huh? Without putting support or keeping the attunement or the connection with the child, right? So even if they don't hear it from the mama, they hear it collectively from the white institution. So as parents, we have to equip our children by first equipping ourselves, and that's healing.
Makes sense. Wherever, I'm going to go ahead and shoot to this break real quick because I want to ask you about examples of what that may look like. I'm pretty sure that's different and varies per individual, but just, you know, I think making connections to what healing is, I think real life examples help people kind of understand, oh, okay,
that, you know, one is connect to somebody who can help them, like yourself, right? But just even hearing examples of maybe something people did, I would love to hear out of the break. If you want to get in, 646-787-1691. You have to press 1. For the callers that's been hanging out, you do have to press 1 if you're trying to get in. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Mental Dialogue Talk Show, where all I ask is that you think.
Hey, are you a wine drinker?
A little bit here and there, but my wife definitely loves hers. Why you ask?
Man, you gotta try this vegan wine by Sip and Share Wines. I ran across them at this event in Atlanta, and now I keep me a few bottles at the house. What flavor you like?
I like me a good red or maybe a nice dipping deal or something. You know what I'm saying?
Okay, try this sweet red first.
That's nice and smooth right there. Yeah, that's kind of sweet like I like it. You know what I'm talking about?
For sure. That's why I like that one as well. Hey, now try this Conjure Zinfandel. This one was featured in Forbes magazine as a top 10 drink for the summer. See what you think.
Oh, okay. Now that's fire right there. Where can I get a bottle of that?
Just go to sipandsharewines.com. They'll ship it right to your door. They black on, too.
Oh, yeah? Okay, you said what? Sipandsharewines.com? Is that it?
Yep.
There's a kind of a fundamental basis for post-traumatic slave syndrome. How many of you are familiar with post-traumatic stress disorder? But when we start talking about chattel slavery, we're not talking about one trauma. We're not talking about a specific event. We're talking about generations of trauma with no intervention. Based on what I know about sugar plantations, tobacco, and the Caribbean, what I know about American chattel slavery and the plantations there, does anyone right now ever recall mental health assistance to slaves? Anybody remember sending in the therapist after I sold off your son, daughter, raped folks? At any point, never. Second question. After slavery was officially over, now you're free. Anybody remember any therapy then? We know it's been rough, it's been deep for you, it's been difficult, we're going to do a little group therapy. Anybody remember that? That would be no. Number three, after slavery officially ended, both in the States, in the Caribbean, the British ended, do you remember whether or not trauma continued? Did the trauma continue for people of African descent? I need to know. Okay, so now let's do the math. Hundreds of years of trauma, no treatment. Freed, more trauma, no treatment. What do you do the math? Do you think there may be residual impacts of that trauma? Of course there is. It didn't end, friends, and it hasn't ended yet. So I think, on one point, African people and people of African descent are extremely resilient. Matter of fact, I think we're a miracle.
Welcome back to the Mental Dialogue Talk Show. I'm your host, Montoya Smith, a.k.a. Black Socrates, along with special guest co-host Latrice Ross. This morning's discussion question, shame shifting, how do I overcome feelings of inadequacy and shame? My special guest is Dr. Curtis Jaspers. We hear another cut from Dr. George DeGruy, kind of speaking to a lot of the historical context, and here's where I would love to take in a sense of, we kind of in a sense talk about how a lot of this shame may come from how we were parented and our parents without, as you mentioned, Dr. Kurt, without dealing with all how they were parented, then they may in a sense pass down. And so what I would offer is typically what that we're most shameful of quite often is what we come to hate about ourselves. I'm just kind of thinking of my own, you know, in a sense, personal journey. And so what does it look like, if I'm even correct, in that most people will process whatever area as an area that they hated about themselves because they've inadequately decided that they're bad because of it versus, like you said, it was just a thing that was done. So when someone's processing that way, what does taking the steps to get out of that even look like if they've been doing that for a lifetime, if that makes sense?
Right. That's good. So keep in mind the ultimate goal is to learn how to separate who we are from what we did, right? And so when it comes to things like being shamed and an attempt to protect yourself by now hating something about yourself. Hate is in place of unacceptability, right? You hate it because you haven't accepted it, right? You mm-hmm. understand it. You've been shamed for it, right? The way to get around that hating something that you probably cannot change or at least don't feel you can is to accept it. Again, that's you connecting. Because you got to keep in mind that kids, as kids, even us, kids are naturally born resilient, right? They when they mm-hmm. practice walk, they fall down, they don't quit. When they tease and they chew on the other side or gnaw on something or cry, like kid, we all born with a natural resilience. Because most of us have been shamed, toxically, consistently shamed, we have taught ourselves how to diminish and unaccept certain things about us in the form of hate. I tell people every day, I ain't asking you to love it. I'm just asking you not to hate it. Slide back down and find something a little more comfortable so that you can continue to thrive, right? And there's ways to do that, right? There's ways to do that. I'll use myself as an example. Coming up, I'm a full-featured, big-nosed black dude, right? Coming up, right? Of course, we all got teased. I had a few defense mechanisms. I learned how to tease back, right? I learned how to protect myself. But I also learned how to accept that this is my father's nose and this was his father's nose, right? And so part of me hating that was denouncing the traits that came through my lineage. And we had more gifts than being teased for a wide nose, right? So I didn't hate it. I actually honored it that the genes was passed down, and I, in fact, know who my damn daddy is. I'm being funny, but we learn how to protect ourselves in a variety of ways. I did not. Because I was taught who I was from what I did, it was easier for me to do those minor adjustments as opposed to hiding in plain sight, getting a nose job, worrying about somebody saying this, I got a big nose. If you got a big head and you accept it, who going to point out you got a big head? If somebody be like, boy, your nose big, I'd be like, I know, right? You see my dad's nose? And we keep it in movies, right? Exactly. Like, have you seen my pops? Bruh gave me the nose, but he also gave me some gifts. And that's how we have to do. There's a difference between who we are and what we have. There's a difference between who we are and what we did. There's a difference between who we are and what we did not do. Kids are naturally born resilient. We teach that out of them by shaming them.
Nah, that's important. Latrice, you know, we're personal friends, so I know you've had to actually do the work to process some of your childhood shame, if you will, to the space that you're in to now where you help others, if you will. But if you could even speak to that, because as I'm hearing Dr. Kurt say, he was, you know, based on his mother, the kind of way she raised him, he didn't take it on as that's who he were. Who he was. I don't think that was necessarily your journey from what I recall as a young person. You're there now, clearly, and living out beautifully, abundantly, and authentically who you are. So that's how I know you. That's how I pretty much met you to a degree. But you've told me that's not necessarily, you know, a lot of us didn't know how to process as quickly as Dr. Kurt was able to with, you know, certain aspects for himself. Your journey, if you will, Queen.
Oh, that's, you know, mine was definitely not that way. I didn't learn to I guess, address it adequately. I internalized it a lot, that caused me to turn away. I turned to books and readings and things of that nature, so I wasn't one to really extend myself easily because I wasn't sure how I could navigate imperfection. And so I chose not to participate at all in a lot of instances. And so it wasn't until, you know, I began to think inwardly about my journey in life and realize that I still had some things that some undealt with trauma from my childhood that I needed to address in order to be the adult that I believe I was meant to be. That's why I'm a huge advocate of therapy. I think that every black person in this country needs to be in therapy just by virtue of being born black and living in this country. And just the impact of how we were raised, because our parents raised us the way their grandparents raised them. And so those
types of things that we call generational curses, which are really traumas handed down, continue to be so prevalent in our community. I was having a conversation with someone. She was talking about being almost raped by an uncle and how it was her dad's brother. And when she finally realized that her parents were not going to press charges, dad said, well, he didn't rape you. We caught him in time. Not understanding the impact of what happened to her and how they addressed it, that she would carry that with her into adulthood, into being nearly 50 years old. She's still trying to process what her dad did or didn't do when she was 13. And so we got to begin to look inwardly and do the work. And sometimes we got to walk away from friends and family because they keep us stuck in a place of shame and embarrassment.
No, very true. Culturally, Dr. Kurt, if you will, just kind of addressing this again for the culture, if you will, we definitely, hopefully, for people out there listening, they'll be able to process some, you know, in a sense, what we're saying and how it affects them individually. But I would offer that, and I think you speak to this quite often, the narratives, like you just mentioned, and going to those, you know, that school or whatever, what the children may be getting at that school, if you will. But we know that these narratives live in media to the extent that there's, I would say, underlying shame that is applied to our community that has happened for so long that as a culture we've accepted certain things that deep down really are shameful, but our coping mechanism is to, in a sense, maybe to rebel or maybe to laugh it off, all these things that we're talking about. But there are things that, again, if we're not protecting our Black children's mind, they're up against more of these narratives that also will have them shameful of their skin. Well, and, you know, have them, if you will, you know, doing the Dahl test just a decade ago and getting slightly better results than the Dahl test got in the before the Brown. I shouldn't say slightly, but still not the greatest results just a decade, probably about 15 years ago. I think it was done now, if I get my timing right. But maybe about 15 years ago, it was better results than the 50s before the Board of Education, you know, versus Topeka, Kansas Board of Education. Better results, but not much, not enough, not something to be proud of, you know, 40, 50, 60 years later, and Black kids are still choosing white dolls more so than Black dolls even just 15 years ago. Just any thoughts to, again, the collective shame that the narrative of America will give our children and what parents can and must do to protect their Black mind, their children's Black minds from any of that collective shame that America will try to put on us.
Right. So I think we've personally done a good job with collective shame, right, and collective trauma. Not a great job, but keep in mind, and here, I want to be very clear on this, right?
Okay.
We've learned to work through collective shame and collective trauma as a result of post-traumatic slave syndrome, right? When we are in connection, when we are in attunement, then it doesn't seem as traumatic. Now, there are some internal things that we must continue to work on. But using the example that Latrice said, right, it becomes traumatic on an individualized level, especially when our young girls have been violated, when the adults have not protected them. They internalize the feeling of, I'm all alone, right? The trauma stays in the body because of the feeling of, I'm all alone. Nobody came to save me, right? Which is why group therapy and collection are good things, are very useful things. So, for example, if growing up in Chicago, there are certain things that came with the trauma, right? All my boys, we all got jumped on. We all got robbed at gunpoint. That was part of growing up on the streets of Chicago. Right, but because it was collective, we've learned how to navigate it. We know where to go, what to dress, who to be with, how many to hang. Right, those who did not share their traumatic and felt all alone carried that in their body, and they still working through it. We had learned as a collective how to move mm. through the trauma.
Mm.
Right?
Wow,
to survive.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's amazing to me to hear you put it in that perspective. You're almost saying that if I'm hearing it correctly, that what maybe outside looking in, somebody who doesn't understand that world at all, right, that the adaptive behaviors in the collective were actually, you're saying, was actually effective because at the end of the day, it helped you survive what outside looking in may seem extra dangerous. And you're like, no, that collectiveness and those tactics that don't make sense to an outsider actually is a form of doing what you're talking about. Am I hearing that correctly?
Yeah, that's the appropriate
adoption
behavior. Yeah, that's exactly right. People ask me all the time, how you not gang bang and sell dope in Chicago? Well, I could tell them I did well in school and I went to college, but the real reason is I learned some appropriate adaptive behavior since I was placed on the streets. My parents are born and raised in Chicago. My mother, born in the project of Chicago, she taught me appropriate adaptive behaviors, right? She had to for my sense of survival. This is what you do. This is where you go. This is how you walk, you talk, because I need you to make it back home.
Yeah, as I listen to that, it's, again, I love that appropriate adaptive behavior. It's almost like, so realizing using it for the moment, and then when you're out of that environment, the process of, okay, let me no longer do that. Not always easy, counsel, how long you were in that environment, right? Not always easy to do, but it's like, just hearing the distinction makes a lot of sense, Dr. Kurt. I'm over against another break. Let me do this break and we'll continue this conversation. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Mental Dialogue Talk Show, where all I ask is that you think.
Are you intimidated by money? While this is a question most people never think to ask themselves, but when forced to think about it, many people realize they have unrecognized fears that truly affect how they deal with money. If you want to learn more about money and the fears that keep you from prosperity, join us for Making Money Matter Monday, where money meets mental health with personal finance coach Ashley Thomas and psychotherapist Dr. Katrina Pitts. Every second Monday of the month, find out if you're intimidated by money and what to do about it. To receive a link to this free Zoom event, please DM the Making Money Matter or the Mental Dialogue Instagram pages or contact 404-604-9477.
Clients tell me during intake, I think I have a split personality. I'm fine one moment, but then in the blink of an eye, I can get really upset. After completing the intake questions, I usually end up saying, you don't have a split personality. You have an adult and a wounded child. I then explain that the adult is a metaphor for the part of the brain that is rational, lives in the present moment, and sees things as they are, right here, right now. While the wounded child is a metaphor for the part of the brain that contains the unhealed emotional wounds from childhood and sees the present as the past. The important thing to understand is that these unhealed wounds can be jabbed, poked, and brushed up against by current events, resulting in an intense knee-jerk reaction, just as if someone bumped into your badly bruised knee. Significant unhealed childhood wounds fester in the background until the stimulus in the present brushes up against them, releasing a flood of repressed emotional pain that instantly turns your rational adult into an intentionally emotional and irrational wounded child. For example, if you were verbally abused and relentlessly criticized as a child, and then 20 years later your spouse says, "Honey, I think you hung the picture a bit off center," your wounded child can become flooded with repressed pain and then instantly react with an intense anger that seems to come out of nowhere. But it doesn't. It comes from your wounded child. Since your wounded child reactions are overreactions, fueled by past pain rather than present reality, you react in ways that seem irrational, which is confusing to you and others. So you feel out of control, embarrassed, and angry at yourself, which only increases your sense of shame and isolation. Clients usually hate their wounded child, even though the wounded child still longs for what every child needs: love, acceptance, nurturance, and protection. Thus, to heal your wounded child and become whole, you must bridge the gulf that separates the adult from the wounded child, which means your adult must love, nurture, and protect your inner child, which is called reparenting the wounded child.
Welcome back to the Mental Dialogue Talk Show. I'm your host, Montoya Smith, a.k.a. Black Socrates. Special guest co-host, Latrice Ross, this morning's discussion question, shame shifting. How do I overcome feelings of inadequacy and shame? My special guest is Dr. Curtis Jasper. We hear a cut about the wounded child. I want to relate it to what we were just talking about, Dr. Curtis, if you will, and the idea of me, again, just kind of understanding how you broke down the A, collectively, that's how you survive. You had some appropriate adaptive behavior at the time. It made me think of how people coming out of certain environments, how they can struggle in a quote-unquote environment where you don't necessarily have to survive, but you're in a new environment. It's not that environment. Or you go into the professional world, and some of what Latrice talked about, where you don't feel like you fit in because you're still reacting with the in a sense, the appropriate behavior for another environment, and when you use that in another place, it's deemed inappropriate. And so I've seen people who should be in a space leave a particular job because of not understanding and not taking it personal of a mistake they may have had because of being in a past environment, and they've now misused that behavior unknowingly in a new environment. Like, talk to me about what that looks like, because I think a lot of Black men and women have to navigate that as they progress throughout society to some version of progression, I'll say, based on what they might want to do, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's a lot to go with that. You know, I do a lot of corporate talks when it comes to how to support people of color and Black people in particular in these corporate arenas, the attempt to address the diversity, equity, and inclusion thing. One of the things that I have to remind us is that we all have survival mechanisms, right? So it doesn't mean a bad thing, right?
Right.
We all have appropriate adaptive behaviors depending on our environment. The challenge is when we start, A, internalizing it when it becomes just unhealthy, and B, haven't done the work with some of our previous wounds. Right. And so the recording, it gave a great example of that. So what we don't work on, we will be exposed on an intimate level. And anything that you do that you are forced to give of yourself, there's some exchange of intimacy, even in the workplace. Right. And so without doing that work, we get exposed. And exposure feels shameful and it feels embarrassment. And if your defense mechanism is to flight or flee, or fight, you're going to do just that, right? Because you have a built-in defense mechanism. That's how you learn to survive. That's why we're still here. The question is it manageable for you, or is it in your way? How do you manage the unhealed portion of your beingness regardless of your situation?
So that's how we got teachers with no panties on beating up students?
Exactly. Exactly. The real reason, but again, that's collective, right? That's collective. What we do have is a shortage of teachers. What we do have is one of the most important professions on the globe, and they overworked and underpaid, right? So they'll accept any. I started off in teaching, right? I started off as a classroom teacher in Chicago public schools. That's exactly what we do. That's exactly what they did. And the kids were, you know, it wasn't a cell phone issue then, but they said stuff again. So that's a perfect example. That's a perfect example.
Latrice, your thoughts, Paladins?
But, you know, there is a flip side to this. Like, I recently interviewed, and it was with a white, it was a third interview, and it was with a white man. And he had the talent acquisition person tell me that they chose someone with more executive presence. And when I looked, it was a white woman. But even before I knew it was a white woman, I actually kicked myself out of the running for that position because I corrected him. And I informed him what executive presence is built upon and or based upon. It's white heterosexual men. And that I, as a diversity, equity, and inclusion professional, did not subscribe to those theories that I needed to fit in. I don't believe in the concept of culture fit. I believe in culture add. And so in the corporate space, Black folk have to contend with perhaps some of it's unhealed from childhood, but then it's, you know, you have to heal yourself from the societal norms. You know, just the very act of having to cover in the workplace, cover aspects of who you are to fit in, there's a tax, there's a penalty tax for doing that. It comes in the way of exhaustion, ambivalent feelings towards your role in an organization. And so, you know, when we look at mental well-being for Black people, it's entirely different than for the majority population. And many of us don't recognize the pressure that it places upon us for Black men to diminish themselves in meetings so that they don't appear to be threatening. It's just so many nuances that we as a collective community of people have to contend with to simply earn a living. Black women having our hair legislated to wear the way it grows out of our scalp naturally. It's just so many things where the work that Dr. Kirk does and the work that I do is beginning to intersect now in the workplace, where organizations are coming to recognize that if I just allow my employees to be authentically who they are, then I get more bang for their salary. I get more effectiveness. I get better products. I get better projects. So, it's coming of age, but we still have a long way to grow.
Right. And this question this morning is, how do I overcome the feeling of inadequacy and shame? And so when I listen to Dr. Kirk, when I listen to Latrice lay it out, you know, particularly in this area, whether, you know, corporate or whatever you work from, and knowing that, again, society is typically not going to be the most supportive of us, in particular as African Americans. Again, that's typical. And so what does overcoming that look like in a company where they're not fortunate enough to have a Latrice or have a Dr. Kirk come in and talk to the company to try to improve those things? And sometimes, you know, it's a matter of leaving, but you're up against the reality of, can I take care of home? So these are, I think this is what Latrice is speaking to, the levity, if you will, of these things that are reality. What is moving out, getting to a space of adequacy? Because I do think, and I think this is how you live, just watching you outside looking in, Dr. Kirk, is once you get over these things that become adequate, it helps you navigate and move, whether that's getting out of those type of spaces altogether and having your own thing. Again, I'm not overly romanticizing everybody becoming their own boss like you see on the internet. I'm not doing that at all. But just even being able to find your fit, when you're adequate, it becomes easy. But that process of recognizing how to, when you're up against bills per se or raising your family, just speak on that, if you will. And I know I'm saying a lot, but just wherever you can fit in, jump in there, Dr. Kirk.
Oh, yeah, that was good, man. You brought up a lot, and that was good. Yeah, I mean, you know my position, man. We still asking white folks for acceptance, claiming that that's the way we got to pay our bills and take care of our families. No, it's based on the predication of how we was raised and our woundedness. If you grew up trying to prove yourself, of course you're going to take that in the workplace, right? You're going to do it, right? If you grow up knowing who you are versus what you did, you may be more apt to try things on your own, to look for problems in the community and see how you can authentically be yourself while solving them. We still walking in white corporate America thinking we got to explain stuff like executive presence stuff. White folks clear about how that works. They clear about it. We still think that pointing it out to them is going to make a difference. There's more genius. We built this country. There's brilliance and genius if we collaborate. Right, collectively join forces, do more forums like this. We are selling our kids on what to do and what not to do, fight against it, still asking white folks to pay us, which they never can based on our work, right? When we get who we are and collectively come together, our job is not to be exhausted from a corporate job to have your ass working 15 hours a day talking about this is your title based on the degrees. That's nonsense. That's
nonsense. Let me say
that
again.
That's more of the PTSS.
That's non damn motherfucking sense.
It's sense. It's for real, man. For real.
Nah,
like
I hate
that.
Man.
We throw our kids to that. Get grades, go to these colleges, get grades, and then go sit around the table, across the table, and let a white boy tell you that you ain't something. I wish I would. I live in a box before I let white boy tell me anything about who I am. I will live in a tent before I give up my dignity and self-respect for any job for any amount of money.
Absolutely right. And that, to me, that was growth on my part for me to say, you know what, let me check you. Because it's not that I don't have executive presence. And I had no problem sending that email to him, the chief human resources officer, as well as the CEO of that company. Because,
you felt you had to. They know. You felt you had to tell them. They know. They know. We don't educate white folks when they mistreat us. We don't educate white folks when they mistreat us.
Absolutely. So I'm like, no, you don't get away with telling this to me. And I explained, I made that a full teachable moment for them. I don't expect you to call me back for this role, but I'm good because you're not the kind of company that I want anyway. So you do you, but let me help you understand that you don't tell a black woman that they don't have executive presence. We may not fit into your mold, but we create the mold that so many of them want to fit in. And so
we don't tell white folks when they mistreat us. We remove ourselves. We don't educate white folks on what black women are. That is nonsense. They know the audacity of them having to tell us that, of us going in asking to be a part of their corporations and then gaining some posture by telling them this is what y'all did. They are in the boardrooms laughing like, it's our shit.
Yeah,
they come to us. They come to us for the job. We didn't come to them. They didn't come to us. We came to them, and then when they mistreat us, we think we told them something. The way to show your value is to remove your presence.
So,
period.
To a certain degree, I agree with that, but we do have to take into account that their lived experiences, and they live in homogenous groups, their lived experiences are not like ours. And so in some instances, there is a sense that there has to be some education that takes place.
So let me say
it doesn't.
Let me say that real quick. Let me jump in, y'all. If I have it, give me a second. Just a piece of clarity. So I would throw this out to you, Latrice, and see what that, before you respond, Dr. Kurt. I would throw out the instances when that's done best is when there is a human effort on their part or someone else's part to figure it out. In the situation, Dr. Kurtz, the situation that you were in, there's no looking or need to figure it out. I'm just saying the only time that you would, in my opinion, should offer is when there's an effort to say, I don't understand that. If somebody throws that olive branch, in my opinion, you can say, are they being sincere? If you decide, based on your relationship, they're being sincere, teach all you may. But I'm with Dr. Kurt. In this situation, that's never necessary, nor should we even waste time doing it for your own sanity purpose. The energy of I need to tell them is advantage white man, in my opinion. Dr. Kurt?
Right.
Let me let you finish, then go with Dr. Kurt. Go ahead, finish Latrice.
That was my stance for a long time. But then when I started to do the research about a whole two or three generations who've been raised to not see color and the impact that the research says that's had on their understanding of differences, that makes a difference. And so when I look at it from that perspective and not like
no, it doesn't make a difference. It makes us feel better. It makes us feel better about who we are. It don't make a difference to them. Let me give you an example, right? So we have I do talks, keynotes for corporations on diversity, equity, and inclusion all the time, right? They have these heads of department who are black who Google some of the speakers in that. They'll call me, right, say, hey, we want you to speak to our black and brown. We have funding. White boy gave us some funding on the black resource, all of that. Can you speak to it? Yeah, and I get right on the Zoom with a T-shirt, with my tats on, and tell black and brown folks the very thing I'm telling now. Yeah, they will pay you. You ain't got to do it in their house. These white folks will pay you to tell the ones who have not walked away
how that they are doing a good job or a weak attempt to support them mentally, spiritually, and emotionally. But they going to hire me on this Zoom in the privacy of my own home for $5,000 to tell black folks that this is nonsense. We are not here to educate white folks. They know this country is built on slavery. Shadow slavery, they know. We feel good when we tell them, right? But again, that's more of us trying to prove ourselves, right, that we're standing up for ourselves and that we know something, as if they need to be taught. They don't need to be taught. They are clear on how racism and oppression works. No exceptions to that.
You say that if they were the founding fathers who built this country on the backs of slavery, but you're looking at a generations of people who don't know about the black experience because they've never lived it, they've never been around it. And so they have this certain perception about how black people are or how we are based on what they see on TV, on the news, and in TV shows about us. So we can't say that they should know because that this is not their lived experience. They haven't been taught. They haven't been around it. And we can say because white people created white supremacy and because they built this country on the backs of slavery that they should know, but they shouldn't know because they don't live it. They haven't been around it. And the way that our schools are set up, they haven't been taught about it.
I didn't say they should know. I said they do know. They know from
they
a political,
not.
Social, geo. Let me explain this to you. White folks know the privilege of being white. They don't have to know the nuances in watching videos and TikToks. White people know that they benefit.
Go on in time. Let him finish, and I'm going to let you come back, Latrice. Go ahead.
White folks are clear about their privilege. We're not talking nuances about they don't know about this. That's not the bigger picture. White folks know that they benefit from being white. They understand racism. They also understand, right, while playing ignorant, that they benefit greatly. So this whole, like, they don't know, they need to be taught. Really? We know what it means to be black. We live it. They know what it means to be white. We don't know about how to make white potato salad, but we know it's different than black potato salad. We don't have to know the intricacies to get it. That's nonsense. We go to these white folks asking them to help us prove our worthiness, how much you want to pay us, right? We'll fit our family in as a result of you, the work we do for you. And then when we don't like something, we're going to come back to you and cry about it. We ain't going to start our own. We ain't going to line up with no black folks. We ain't going to take our gifts and talents to our own corporations. We're going to still try to think we educating white folks. That's nonsense to me.
And that's your perspective, you said to you. But when I look at the research and how things have changed and how things have evolved over time, based on how folks were raised and the surroundings, their lived experiences, it's more than that. It's more than they should know. Yes, there are some people who understand white privilege, but to the average blue-collar worker who's out here working side-by-side with somebody on the street in front of my house who's working, doing road work, they don't feel like there is any privilege to being white because they're working. They feel that they're working just as hard as that black man that they're sitting next to. And that's where there's a lot of resistance because there has not been any education. And you have all of these poor white people who haven't been taught to understand the differences and who haven't been taught to understand that, yeah, you might be getting paid a dollar or two more than this black dude sitting next to you, and it's simply because of the white skin you were in. All they know is that I'm out here struggling and toiling just like he or she is, and so therefore I don't believe in white privilege. So it's not a black and white thing. It's very gray and it's very murky, and if we fall into that paradigm, then we do get stuck because, as Montoya mentioned earlier, it's not everybody wants to start their own. Not everybody has the desire or even the capabilities to start their own. And there are not enough black corporations around to support or sustain population, because I'm sure if there were, that we would run in droves to be a part of those organizations. So it is quite nuanced.
Yeah, we'd be null and void if we had those. I hear where I think both of you are correct in this. And again, this is what we do on Mental Dialogue. We talk it out through all of our opinions. And so here's where I hear I do agree that the majority of the white population is unaware in the way that Latrice spoke about. She and I spoke about that as well. I think even Latrice understands this part of what you said, Dr. Kurt. She understands that even in the level of unawareness that we're speaking to, she also understands that they get the benefit, even if it's quote unquote subconscious, not even something they're conscious of. So they're absolutely able to walk into the benefit, even if they can't consciously say so, to a degree. I hope I'm making sense here. So I don't think that y'all are completely missing each other completely. And again, partly for me knowing where Latrice is coming from, I do get what you're saying when you're saying, hey, they know the advantage. I don't disagree with you at all. I will throw out some improvement that I think each younger generation experience in their interactions with one another comes from, I would say, some of the dialogue that Latrice is saying she wants to have. The only caveat I would throw on that, and again, it's not about whether we all agree, the only caveat I would throw on that, I think is only worthy where there is a desire for understanding. I think, similar to you, Dr. Kurt, you may consider it a waste of time at all times. I definitely think it's a waste of time when there is no desire for understanding, because some people do show there's clearly no desire nor want to, I think, to your point. And that's when I do agree with you that it is a waste of time. I think it is valuable due to the world becoming global, where in a sense, interaction throughout the world is going to happen amongst various groups. There were 2053, we were supposed to be majority, minority in this country, for whatever that means. I think that number is actually moving up based on birth rate, so it may be sooner. So there will be forced interaction. And when I say forced interaction, I'm not talking about just black and white, but I think it's only worthy to even consider it when whoever that other or that person who looks like me or comes or doesn't look like me or come from a different culture, I think it's only worth it when there is value exchanged on both sides that starts the conversation and there's understanding that wants to be had. If it's just you wanted to go the way you go, I don't care what you are. I don't care to interact or be in your space similar to you. Dr. Kurt, again, I'm just trying to bring a synopsis of how I hear each of you. Dr. Kurt, I'll kind of let you respond and if you will, let people know, we only got 3 minutes, let people know how they can stay in contact with you, and then I'll let Latrice end us out on the last minute. So if you can knock it out in a couple minutes, and then I'll leave Latrice, my co-host, the last minute. Go ahead. Thank you so much for being here.
I appreciate you, Latrice. I respect your perspective. I get it, right? I also get it, you know, in more ways than most, because I'm on a receiving end of working with a large majority of black men who are working through challenges. What I do know, to your point, is if I got a white man and a black man working outside my house and the white man is getting paid $2 more, the distinction is he knows if the police pulls up, he's less likely to get killed. He knows that. He don't have to know what type of jeans I'm wearing or if my greens got meat in it. He knows that. He knows that. In addition to it, can he say, oh, we all struggling? Yeah. But he also knows his position in this country. Now, globally, they are the minority. It's always been like that, right? But here's what I'd like to close out with. We just got to do our individual healing. And not so much of the difference in perspective based on our previously lived experiences. Is our lives working for us at this time at a high level? And what areas do we need to work on? That's what I say. And that includes me. Most of us are still trying to grab up to corporate or the entrepreneurial ladder at the expense of our emotional and our physical health. Without our physical health, none of this is even worth talking. We wouldn't even be on this phone on a Saturday morning if we weren't physically healthy. I challenge all of us on this phone and the listeners to turn up the physical health and wellness so that we can be around to have these conversations for years to come. Thank you, Latrice, Brother Montoya. It is an honor to rock with you. Please look me up. Follow me on social media, Dr. Curtis D. Jasper. I am Dr. Kurt on social media. Anytime I can pull up, y'all know I'm here.
No, I love it. This is perfect, man. And like you said, you did a post that turned into a full 2-hour show. So applaud and salute to you, King. So thank you for being with us. Latrice, 1 minute.
All right.
If you want to let people know on you, go ahead as well. You got the last minute. Thank you, Queen.
So to the point about knowing that they get pulled over, they don't.
Actually, I figured that out through conversations that I've had, because they don't live that experience. What they do see, what the media and entertainment presents, is that black people are inherently criminal, and many of them believe that. And so it goes far beyond knowing that I have white privilege when it comes to that. So regardless, we have differing perspectives. I can respect that, and I do respect your perspective and agree with certain aspects of it. I can be found on social media, Latrice Ross, or Atrice Ross, and love the work I do. I've enjoyed the conversation this morning, and as always, I enjoy co-hosting with you, Montoya.
All I ask is that you think. See y'all next Saturday.
Appreciate you got to talk to more black folks, Ms. Ross. Talk to more black folks. I'll see y'all later.
That's all she do, brother. All right, we later. We out.